Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Wood, coal, oil. The energy market has long been a major driver of the economy. I mean, the economic and political history of the 20th century was largely shaped by the geopolitics of oil. So what about now? What is the effect of energy on global politics these days? Here are just a few of the hot topics. The shale gas and oil revolution, the turmoil in the Middle East, growing concerns over global climate change, and the rise of alternative energy sources like solar and wind. To get a handle on how developments in the energy market may shape America's geopolitical future, I recently interviewed Megan O'Sullivan. She's the author of Windfall, How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. O'Sullivan is professor of the practice of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She is also director of the Geopolitics of Energy Project. Between 2004 and 2007, she was special assistant to President George Bush. So I started off our conversation by observing that the key to her book is the belief that we move from a world of energy scarcity, fears of energy shortages, to one where energy abundance is the overriding theme. So I asked her, why was she so confident we won't go back to the old world of shortages or scarcity?
The energy world, in particular oil markets, have been cyclical. So there have been ups and downs. And this fear of energy scarcity, or what many people knew as peak oil, has been with us for decades. And it's kind of waxed and waned and, you know, been prominent in people's thinking, and then it's declined. And I'm arguing in this book and in general that we are in a different reality.
Okay, so let's break this down a little bit. Is it time to bury the idea of peak oil?
You know, I argue that it is. And this is a pretty radical idea for people who work in this field because, as I said, this is an idea that has, you know, had more than nine lives. It just keeps reappearing. But, you know, I'm arguing, and here's a key distinction, not that we're not going to see high oil prices again. There'll be some reason, there'll be some geopolitical upset, there'll be some kind of mismatch between supply and demand in the future. That means, you know, we will see another period where we'll have some oil prices that are considered to be very high. But what I'm arguing is this is not going to be a lasting phenomenon. And in fact, that this fear that we're running out of energy, this fear of peak oil, which was really this idea that the world didn't have enough energy resources to meet its needs, I think that's no longer going to drive big decisions. So it's not going to drive strategies of countries or of militaries or probably even strategies of most companies or certainly individual investors. So in that sense, in terms of like a strategic concept, I think it's pretty much seen its day.
So do you see gas is to the global energy market what oil was in the 20th century? Gas is to the 21st century?
It's possible. It is very interesting because if you look at, there are a number of companies and international agencies that come up with scenarios about what the energy future might look like. And that most of these scenarios, if you project them out to say 2040 or beyond, most of them have oil and coal as losing market share. So they become less important to the global energy mix over time. Natural gas is the only fossil fuel that has, in many scenarios, a promising future. So I do think that natural gas is seen to be by many countries and leaders as a bridge fuel, meaning that it will be important to help the world make that transition from a fossil fuel-dominated economy, which is where we are now. More than 80% of the world's energy needs are met by fossil fuels, to a situation where we're using more renewable energy. So natural gas will play a big role in that. But a lot of that, in how long that curve lasts, depends on the policies of many, many countries around the world.
And so is the United States going to become a major exporter of gas?
Well, it's interesting. Just this year, 2017, we did become an exporter of natural gas. And that was a very big phenomenon for the United States. It still is not a major exporter, although in, you know, the 6 or 9 months since that's occurred, the United States has exported to many countries around the world, Latin America, some to Asia, Europe. So it's beginning to penetrate global markets in a way that's pretty significant. And the potential, and I think the likelihood, is that the United States is going to be a major exporter of natural gas in this liquefied natural gas form. In fact, by many projections, the U.S. will become one of the top three exporters of natural gas alongside Qatar and Australia. And that will have a very big effect on global natural gas markets. And in fact, we've already had a big effect on global natural gas markets because we used to be a big importer. So all that natural gas that we were importing from the West Africa, from the Middle East, from Qatar, from other places, now all that natural gas has had to find a home elsewhere. So even before we became an exporter, we were having an impact on global markets.
So I haven't heard this term as much in recent years, but boy, anyone who lived through the first oil embargo, the second oil embargo, you know, every president seemed to get out there and say, we want energy independence. And now we're talking about exporting natural gas. And there's still this strand of conversation that says this is a huge mistake. We shouldn't be exporting natural gas. We want to be energy independent.
Yeah, this is a pretty fascinating thing to watch because it's, you know, in this day and age, we can say it's been truly bipartisan. So every president from Nixon in the 70s has gone before the American people and has said energy independence is a worthy and important pursuit and that he is going to deliver it within the course of his administration. Of course, all of them failed to do so for a whole range of reasons, but mostly a rapidly growing economy and, of course, consuming more and more energy and needing to look abroad while producing less at home. So this has been a pursuit that has been with us for a long time. In my book, I call it, energy independence is America's unrequited love. You know, we keep on pursuing it, and suddenly, in this most unanticipated way, in the last 10 years, it's actually become feasible. It's actually a possibility. And now the conversation, I think, shifts to a more interesting realm. In the world of politics, I think there's still a lot of political bang for the buck because Americans understand the idea. They understand that it has been a big constraint to have to rely on the rest of the world for vital energy resources. So I think Americans, this is appealing to Americans. But in the more, you know, energy or policy community, there's the acknowledgement that while we're less energy import dependent, we're still pretty big importers. So we were importing 60% of the net consumption of our oil in 2006. And 10 years later, we're down to 20%. So that's a big drop from 60 to 20, but 20 is still significant. And so the question is, do we want to undertake policies which could be very costly, which could be inefficient, to get us to that point where we would be an energy island? And if so, you know, what would the benefits be? And I argue, like many unrequited loves, that actually if you attain it, it's not going to be everything you think it is. So I try to encourage my reader not to focus so much on energy independence, but to focus on having freedom from having to contort your foreign policy in a way that means energy is at the top of your list of priorities. Instead, you want to be able to talk to countries and conduct your foreign policy in a way where energy isn't a major factor or a constraint, and maybe in this case is an asset.
So when I was reading your book, and this leads to my next question, so I'm reading your book and about halfway through, maybe three quarters of the way through, and I thought, you know what? Maybe this book should have had a different title, Windfall, How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens China's Power. Because a major theme of this book is how important China has become to the energy market. And it seems to me that the way the market's going, China's the clear winner.
Well, it's interesting you say that. And Chris, you know, I wish you had been on my Facebook chat where I was soliciting advice for titles and subtitles. But you're right. China's really the other winner here. China actually has huge amounts of natural gas of the variety produced in the United States, actually more than the United States is believed to have. But they haven't quite figured out how to tap it yet. So they're producing it, but in very small quantities. But they've benefited just from the changes in the market. And what I mean by that is you have this energy abundance, which means that energy is much more accessible at a more reasonable price. And this, of course, has been critical for the Chinese because for decades, they have been reliant on what I call a simplified but pretty accurate equation. They've needed to go abroad to get energy to fuel economic growth in order to maintain political stability. And so getting that energy has been an existential challenge for the Chinese and the Chinese Communist Party in particular. And they have devoted enormous resources, and it has been maybe one of the biggest foci of their foreign policy to actually acquiring that energy. And suddenly, we're in this global environment where they can have a lot more confidence that they're not going to have to compete with the United States, potentially even militarily, for energy. That actually the market, if it works just freely and well, has a much greater chance of delivering energy to China than the need to cut off market deals with Venezuela or other, or regimes in Africa that may have real downsides to doing business with them.
Okay, so the theme with China is pretty clear. What are the strategic benefits to the U.S.?
The obvious ones are the ones I think that Americans see every day. They've noticed they've paid a lot less to fill up their car with gas or to heat their homes with natural gas. So there's those kind of pretty straightforward benefits. And there's a lot of economic benefits associated with that. There's been increases in employment during the period after the Great Recession. You really had energy being a driver of national growth in a way that wasn't true for many sectors. So there's been an economic benefit. It's been good for the trade balance. It's been good for jobs, for lots of things along those lines.
So you have a section in your book, you're saying looking ahead, and your first two points are, one, the United States needs to take advantage of this time to global leadership on climate change. Number two, take advantage of this period of time to take leadership in the North American energy market, Canada, U.S., Mexico. Looking at the news today, yeah, we may have an advantage here, but we're squandering our advantage. I don't see us taking global leadership on climate change. I don't see taking global leadership in terms of energy with the North America area. So it's sort of like, okay, yeah, but it's not happening.
Right. Well, I mean, there's definitely a policy plea in this book. So the Trump administration is the first administration to come into office, as I said, since Nixon, where the energy balance is actually favorable. So President Bush, who I worked for, President Obama, they came in and they had a more difficult energy situation. The Trump administration recognizes that energy is actually an asset, not a vulnerability for the United States. But I do think that they have been thinking about energy in too small a box. You know, they basically said, okay, we're in this great energy position. Let's make sure we can produce as much oil and natural gas and coal as we can. And what I'm saying is taking advantage of this moment for America's strategic benefits requires thinking much, much bigger than that. Yes, we want to make sure that there aren't artificial or inefficient constraints on the production of this energy as long as it can be done in an environmentally sustainable way. But we also need to look at how we take advantage of the changes in the landscape that I talked about. So one of the things that has changed is we suddenly had a real basis for cooperating with China on climate. And this was something that was really not insignificant because natural gas has many fewer emissions, about half the emissions of coal. Our big switch away from coal to natural gas, because it was just cheaper, actually allowed us to bring down per capita emissions in a way that gave us credibility to go out and be a leader on global climate change. And this was unexpected, but I think the Obama administration took advantage of this in a positive way, went to China, negotiated a bilateral deal with China on climate. This was really important, not only for climate, but also because the U.S. and China, as your listeners know, have a very difficult relationship. And it's the most important relationship, bilateral relationship in the world. So to take advantage of this does require that we think more than just about producing more oil and gas. We think about how to advance these other objectives that are in America's energy interest, but also in America's foreign policy interest. And I think North America is another great example. Energy can be an important part of NAFTA. But if we take apart NAFTA, we're actually going to not just hurt our own national interests, but we're going to hurt our own energy industry, because our energy industry has benefited hugely from many of the provisions of NAFTA.
My guest is Megan O'Sullivan, author of Windfall: How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. I'm Chris Farrell, in for Carrie Miller. So now let's shift to global climate change and alternative fuels. Last 2 years, I've done a number of interviews with utility executives, and what was really striking, one was really saying, you know, they've been stunned by how much the price of solar is falling. And the other one was talking about how much the power of wind is falling and the scientific advances in making predictions about when wind is going to be blowing and when it isn't going to be blowing. So how does this sort of oil and gas world that you're talking about shift with the rise of alternative fuels?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. And it's one that has been of some concern for people who really, and I would put myself in this category, really think the world is in a place where we need to be transitioning to a more sustainable energy future. So the concern is, particularly natural gas being cheap, is going to take away the impetus to develop these renewable energies. And I think that there's some reason to be concerned about this, because natural gas and solar and wind are very good substitutes. And in fact, natural gas is even superior in the sense that you can get energy from natural gas, you can get electricity from natural gas any time of day, where solar and wind need some kind of backup for when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. So natural gas has been, you know, in competition with these other two sources, although in some cases it's complementary in the sense you can have solar when the sun's shining and natural gas as a backup. So the concern has been, if you have really cheap natural gas, that it is just going to make it hard to make these advances in solar and wind and other forms of renewable energy. So I understand the concern. The facts, you know, are still playing out, but it's quite interesting. What we see happening in the last couple of years is, in fact, that energy investments in renewable sources has really not declined as a result of low natural gas prices. Some of that has to do with the fact that renewable energies are still heavily subsidized in many parts of the world. But there's also the reality that, as you say, the costs of solar and wind in particular are just coming down, because the more and more the world deploys of that kind of energy, the learning curve creates cost advantages. So, in fact, we do see a world where you have natural gas, but you also have burgeoning solar and wind capacity. Now, what's really important and interesting is this question of, when is that going to affect transportation? Because right now in the United States, something around 95% of our transportation, all forms of transportation, are based on petroleum-based fuels. So solar and wind really don't affect oil consumption in the United States, and for the most part, in most parts of the world. So you can have all the advances you want in solar and in wind, and it's not going to affect oil consumption until we get an electrified vehicle fleet. And that will require some advances in storage that we haven't yet seen. But again, I think there's reason to believe, if you believe in the advancement of technology, that those changes will come. And that's why there's some uncertainty about the time frame. But I think then we will see eventually that electrification comes into the transportation realm and will affect demand for oil as well.
Well, has China already made that decision for the world, where China now is the largest electric car market? And it's basically said, by 2019, foreign manufacturers, you have to start making new energy vehicles. Tesla may have advanced the electric car, but China is saying this is the future and it's going to happen, and it's by government mandate.
Well, it is interesting. Just over the last few months, we've seen a number of initiatives, not only in China, but in the UK and as well as in France, where they've said by 2040, we're not going to sell cars that run on petroleum anymore. And so that is sending a very clear market signal, I think, basically saying, OK, there is some kind of timeline in which we could see the shift away from cars that run on fuel towards cars that have other kinds of, they're based on other kinds of energy sources. And the importance of China, as your question suggests, cannot be underestimated. So China is such a huge driver of global energy trends. It is impossible to underestimate that. Basically, what China does affects global demand, affects global markets. And so if China is making a decision that it is going to put the weight of policy, the state, and its consumer behind vehicles that run on other forms of energy, this is going to have a huge impact. And in fact, there's been a lot of talk over the last few years about, well, maybe the Chinese have decided, they see the writing on the wall. If the Chinese people start to drive cars at the same number or buy cars at the same ratio that Americans do, that this will create enormous dependencies on China for foreign oil. And China says, we don't want to have those dependencies. Look at what those dependencies did to the United States. It required the United States to manage this very complicated web of alliances. And China probably thinks it's not interested in doing that. Maybe it's not capable of doing it. So what's its alternative? Well, we're going to actually be a driver in a different kind of energy, and we're going to capitalize on the strategic benefits of being a leader here. So I do think it's a pretty significant message that China is sending. And I think America's policymakers and industry leaders really need to pay attention to that, because that is going to be a source of strategic benefit in the decades ahead. And if we cede this ground to China, I think we'll really live to regret it.
Now, I think you had maybe the total of a page on coal. I want to say a paragraph, but I'm going to say you had more than a paragraph on coal.
But if you add it all together,
a page. Now, we're right now talking about the future. We're talking about alternative energies, China embracing electric vehicles, what's happening elsewhere in the world. And we are talking about coal in much of our public discourse today. But you don't even talk about it.
Right. I talk about coal to the extent that I talk about this shift that we've seen away from coal in the United States towards natural gas. And that's been very dramatic. And that has been really not the result of President Obama's policies, but really the result of market forces, because you just have a lot more natural gas on the American market. It's cheap, and utilities just decided it makes more sense to use natural gas instead of coal because they're such good substitutes. Now, I see that trend as continuing in the United States, although probably slowing and dependent on what kind of policies are put in place by the U.S. government and other state governments. But the big question about coal, I think looking ahead, I don't think there's a bright future for coal in the United States, regardless of what policy changes are made. But again, the big question for coal really is, what happens internationally? Do countries, particularly China and India, do they shift away from using coal to provide the bulk of their energy to using natural gas, or perhaps even skipping that stage and going right to renewables? And that will really determine whether coal globally has a strong future and, conversely, whether climate change is a bigger problem, or if, in fact, the commitments that China and India and other big economies have made to try to move away from coal are fulfilled. And then I think, we will definitely see, we're past peak coal probably in many of these places.
So give us a quick geopolitical tour of the world. And I want to start with the Middle East. I mean, with your thesis, who benefits, who loses? How do we think about the Middle East?
I think the conventional wisdom is that the Middle East is a big loser from these changes that we've been talking about. But what I argue is that in some ways, the picture is not totally gloom and doom for the Middle East for two reasons. One, if we end up being in an environment where we have very low oil prices for a very long period of time, actually the Middle East becomes more important, not less important. And the reason for that is that if oil prices are very low, if we go around the world, places where it's expensive to produce oil, they're going to stop producing oil. And so more and more of what the world consumes will, in fact, come from the Middle East. The second reason, and this is really one of the most interesting international stories to be watching, is what these changes in oil markets have done to the thinking of leaders in the Gulf in particular. It has really, they look at oil markets and they say something is totally different than it was before. There's something fundamentally different at work here. And our economic model, and therefore maybe our political and social models, aren't going to work in the future. Because we have to be prepared for a world where there's low prices for a long time, and then even potentially going out a few decades, we see a decrease in the demand for oil. So you really see countries trying to get their arms around this idea. And that has really driven some pretty dramatic reform efforts. And of course, I think the most interesting place to watch is Saudi Arabia, where you see the combination of new young leadership and these new economic realities produce this very serious effort at reform, which is, you know, we just saw in the last couple of weeks, the Saudis deciding that women are going to be able to drive. Now, I think this gets back to the whole idea that if you look at the realities in the oil market and you're Saudi Arabia, you know you have to have a different kind of economy, and a different kind of an economy is going to require that you actually are able to tap all of your human resources, and that includes the half of the population that are women.
Okay, and so how about Europe?
You know, Europe has a lot of energy decisions that still have yet to be made. Europe also has a lot of its own shale gas, its own natural gas that it could develop. But Europe as a whole has tended to have a much higher bar in terms of developing those resources, mostly because of environmental concerns, that European populations have been much more prone to want to ban fracking. I think that's the first time we've used that word. But, yep. You know, the technology that has allowed America and other places to produce more of this resource, there's been a much higher bar. And so you see that in many countries in Europe, they're not able to develop this resource. And so I think that in many ways, Europe is looking at an energy future where their energy is now and probably will be more expensive for a long time to come because the Europeans are grappling with this triangle of economic growth and competitiveness and the environment and trying to figure out where they want to maximize their position. So I think there's a lot of energy issues that Europe will have to tackle. But on the whole, I think Europe is a beneficiary from an environment where energy, where markets are just more flush with supplies and that suddenly the consumer, as I said earlier, is more empowered vis-a-vis the producer.
What about Latin America?
Yeah, Latin America, I think there's interesting dimensions at work here. One of the best things about writing this book is I traveled to 20-plus countries to talk to people about this nexus between foreign policy and energy. And there was not a single place I went in the world, and I went to a few places in Latin America.
Yeah, if you need an assistant next time, just get in touch with me. I can sign up for this job. Yeah,
it's been very fun. You know, there's not a single place I've been where when I kind of raise this issue where somebody says, oh, there are no issues there. Every single country, every single person, whether a government official, an academic, an industry person, an activist, everybody has a story that involves, you know, there's an opportunity here or there's a challenge here. So I think if we look at Latin America, what's very interesting is that Latin America had this period where leftist politics were very much on the rise. And that had a lot to do with the fact that these countries are very wealthy in terms of commodities, and it coincided with the commodities boom. So you had socialist governments with a lot of resources. And unfortunately for the people of these countries, most of these governments didn't use this period of boom, with Chile as probably an exception, use this period of boom to kind of build up their reserves and prepare their countries for a rainy day. And so now we're in the rainy day where commodity prices, not just oil, but other commodities as well, have struggled over the last few years. And so you see that a lot of countries in Latin America are having different kinds of financial, not necessarily crises, but constraints. And what this has meant is they're having to reevaluate their relationship with the private sector and with international investment. So, you know, there are big, interesting trends that could connect this energy environment I'm talking about, this one of abundance, with kind of a decline in leftist politics in Latin America. And we see that through a number of governments, whether it's Peru or Argentina is maybe the best example. The other two stories that I think really are worth focusing on now or at some other point is the story in Venezuela, which has a big energy dimension to it, not the only dimension, but a very important one, and that how that country is on the brink of collapse. And Mexico, which has, I would say, a largely very positive energy story, that this new energy environment was one of the things that helped the government of the current president, Peña Nieto, push through really historical energy reforms and open up the economy of Mexico to more foreign investment in a way that holds a lot better prospects for Mexican growth going forward.
So last question, and it's not a small one. Among, if not the most important issues of our time, are dealing with global climate change. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the geopolitics of oil and energy in this world of abundance as opposed to scarcity, how does this interact with concerns over global climate change?
Yeah. I actually devote a whole chapter to this because I think it is so important. And I also think it is an area that has been very polarizing, particularly in the United States, that people feel like they either have to be on the side advocating for development of fossil fuels and oil and gas in particular in the context of the book I'm talking about, or they have to be in the camp of protecting the environment and advancing the quest to combat climate change. And, you know, I really tried to make the case in the book that it is possible to do both and that, in fact, there are ways in which this new energy abundance can be harnessed that can be helpful to global climate change. And the two things which I've mentioned, but I'll just highlight them again quickly, which I think, as you pointed out, we're not taking advantage of, but we still have the possibility to take advantage of, is one, helping ensure by having our own policies and by working with other countries around the world that abundant, cheap natural gas replaces coal, not renewables. That is key to not just the U.S. bringing down emissions, but really other parts of the world, that if India, the rural parts of India get electricity or if Africa is electrified on the back of coal, that will be devastating for the global climate. Now, that can be influenced by policy. And so bringing policy and the market together to ensure that natural gas is what replaces coal, I think is really, really key. And I'm hoping that we can find another way, either through Paris or some other way, of convincing the world that we are willing to play a leadership role here. And I think that will benefit not only the climate, but it will benefit our standing in the world more generally.
Well, I hope you're right. And thank you. I really appreciate you taking your time.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure to be on and to speak to your listeners.
Megan O'Sullivan is author of Windfall, How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. She is professor of international affairs at the Kennedy School of Government.